tonight we're going to be speaking about the currency, the intellectual currency of the foreign policy debate, and the process by which you can get published as a writer, how to be a more effective writer, what editors are looking for, what it's like to edit. And before we get started, we do have our Q&A feature turned on. You can upvote questions that you'd like to see or ask questions of your own. But our guest tonight is Kelly Bocar-Vallejos, the editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, where she's also a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute. She served for 3 years as executive editor of the American Conservative, where she had been reporting and publishing on national security, civil liberties, foreign policy, veterans in Washington politics for a much longer period. She's also worked as director of social media and online editor at WTOP News, which is a very familiar institution if you're here in Washington, 15 years as an online political reporter for Fox News, and also time at Homeland Security Today. So Kelly, welcome.
Well, thank you, John, for having me here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So just to start off, and, you know, you and I have both been in this business at various points since I was at National Interest Magazine. So maybe tell folks what it means to sit on the other side of the desk, you know, and to be the editor as opposed to a writer in a publication. What does an editor do, and how do editors add value for the readers and authors that, of a publication?
Sure. I mean, I did spend a lot of time on the other side. So I'd like to first say that I do bring to my editorship a lot of sensitivity, because I know what it's like to be starting out and writing and developing a name for yourself and a voice in your writing, and working with editors who want to give you a chance and a shot and are, you know, amenable to publishing you and working with you and editing in a good way. So that's where I'm coming from. I have been editing other people's work for some time now, probably, I want to say all told, maybe over the course of the last decade, but very much in earnest since about 2017. I mean, in terms of the foreign policy, national security space, I've done a lot of editing in other arenas too. But I have to say what it means to be an editor. Well, you know, at the beginning of the day, you know, I'm getting emails from people, I'm getting unsolicited pitches from people who I don't know, who are coming through a general mailbox at Responsible Statecraft. And I'm also getting unsolicited pitches from people I do know, like writers who already, you know, I have already worked with, they're a known quantity. And then I have some time that I make for myself to commission stories, things that are going on in the foreign policy world, the headlines, breaking news. And I think of people who are working in those regions, like regional analysts or people who are in Washington and are more generalists. I can talk about grand strategy and politics. And so it's really a mix of those three things. And I have to say the hardest part of my job is getting the unsolicited pitches and determining whether or not I want, or me, and I have two colleagues who I work with every day as well. So they're either getting the pitches through the general, or people are pitching them. And so we have to hash through them. And it's difficult because sometimes you don't know a writer, whether or not their pitch will, you know, their great pitch will match the actual content that comes in, you know, whether or not sometimes you don't know who they are, and you have to spend a little time maybe looking at their CV or their resume, or and most importantly, other content that they might have already published online, and see, hey, is it in line with Responsible Statecraft and the Quincy Institute? Is it in line with our approach to foreign policy? And sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not a good fit. And, you know, we try to get back to every writer, because, you know, each of us have been on the other side, in which you send a pitch to an editor and then you get crickets, and it could be very demoralizing. We tried to get back to every writer on every pitch. And sometimes we'll just take a story and say, listen, we can't guarantee we're going to publish it, but we'd like to take a look at the final draft. And, you know, 8 times out of 10, we'll probably take the piece, because if we're interested in the draft and we had a sense that this person couldn't write and has a good perspective, put together an astute analysis, then we'll probably take it. Very rarely do we not take it, because sometimes it just doesn't come in the way it was promised. And then you go through the editing process, which is, you know, a lot of times there are some people, you get stories, you get articles, analysis, op-eds that are in really good shape. And you maybe do some light editing for style. And then there are some where, you know, they might be coming from outside the country, and perhaps that writer doesn't have the best command of the English language. And a lot of times there are little differences and that you have to tweak. Sometimes it's organizational. So, you know, I guess the hardest part is the commissioning process and editing, and sometimes working with writers can be difficult too. And we can talk a little bit about that as well. But sometimes, you know, sometimes writers come with their own expectations about what they want, whether it be the headlines or the way or the organization. Sometimes they want to give me a 2,000 word piece, and we try to tell them, no, you know, we ask for a maximum of 1,200 words because we feel like that's the sweet spot for op-eds. You go to USA Today or New York Times or whatever, and they'll tell you they want like 850 or 800 words, absolutely top. So 1,200 is generous against today's standards. But, you know, that sometimes the expectations and, you know, the back and forth can get a little awkward. But on the most part, I find that, you know, respecting writers' work, not trying to rewrite their work, not trying to impose my voice or Responsible Statecraft's voice on their content, but editing for style and then make their pieces shine is the way to go, as opposed to, you know, going in and just ripping up a piece so it'll sound more like I would write it. I think you build trust with writers, and over time, your good writers will come back, and that relationship will be smooth. There's always going to be little bumps in the road with new writers, but that's pretty much my day in a nutshell. Well, part of it.
Yeah. Well, and what is, you know, at the end of the day, what makes you look back on it and say, okay, this was a successful day or a less successful day? You know, what's a, what's good look like? What, you know, like maybe even how are you incentivized in terms of like what is success for you?
Well, I mean, and it could be any myriad of things, but I'd say in terms of the editing process, it's success is just, you know, getting a story and, you know, a successful pitch or solicitation or commissioning, getting the story back in a timely manner, being able to edit it, get it back to the writers. So he's on, you know, nine times out of 10. I have some writers that don't care. They trust my editing. They don't need to see it. But most of the time, we'll send the edits back to the writer, and then getting it back in a timely manner and getting it up there and prepped by the end of the day and feeling good about it, feeling like that it's going to do well the next day. People are going to get excited about this piece. People are going to be sharing it. And then you go home and you go, I can't wait for it to come out the next morning. That I would say would make me feel good as I'm leaving the office every day.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely remember from my days at TNI, like I was always most excited about pieces that I thought like, wow, nobody's written this before. This is like right. Something I haven't seen anywhere else. I mean, we had this guy who would go to like, you know, be writing us from like Moldova or something, and like really was able to get, you know, connections with people on the ground and give this just rich understanding of the politics of another country. And you'd be like, wow, like I haven't heard about this before. This is something new. And I mean, honestly, I always tell folks like my time editing was like getting a second master's degree, because just fact checking a piece like that, you have to learn a lot.
Well, that's absolutely right. You really do have to know the material. I mean, it's not, and foreign policy is a challenge. I mean, besides all of the technical aspects that I described, one of the most challenging things is just being able to recognize the material quickly, recognizing the nuance. Now, sure, there are articles that come in, like today, for example, we had one of our regular writers, we asked him to write about Mali, There was a coup there in 2020. There is a military junta in charge, and the countries in the region, Mali's neighbors, have now imposed economic sanctions on the junta, and they're starting to feel the sweat. Now, and Kazakhstan, on the other hand, I've had to go and, you know, sort of like immerse myself for a bit, like what's going on in these countries, because I just had no frame of reference. I'm no foreign policy. I'm more of a generalist. So like at some point, yeah, I'll know like when issues of Iran and Iraq and in Syria and, Venezuela and Russia, things that are most often in the headlines, I have a good grasp of. But then, you know, there are regional conflagrations that come up, and I said, well, okay, I gotta dip in and try to, and if it's a new writer, you have to kind of get a sense of whether what they're saying in their analysis is actually correct. And so at that point, I will go, you know, call a friend and send the piece to there a handful of people that I trust and feel like they're straight shooters, and say, hey, is this off? Does this read well to you? And, you know, just to get the backup, because especially if they're making pointed, you know, assessments about a situation and it's very opinion driven, I gotta know, you know. And the late Mark Perry, who I worked with at Responsible Statecraft, but also at the American Conservative, he was one of my go-to guys, particularly on history and military history issues. I'd be like, if you're there revisiting some event that happened or discussions that happened with, you know, John F. Kennedy and Vietnam and, you know, all of that, I need to call a friend, you know. So a lot of that is, you know, really just getting immersing in the topics and feeling comfortable, you know, editing in that way too. And knowing it when writers need to flesh things out, because in a lot of cases, you know, you'll read and you're like, well, what about this? And what about this? And I think you need to explain to the reader what you mean about this, or are you sure you have that right? And so like, I feel like in this space, the editors really have to know their business. You can't just, it'd be very difficult to hire just a regular editor who just came from a straight news or a general news room and pluck them down and say, now edit this content, because it wouldn't be very easy.
Yeah, so I think that gets to another part of the publishing kind of business. Since you mentioned, hey, there's these people I call, or if there's an author I don't know, I need to do more due diligence.
Yeah.
What is that, you know, what's that kind of good author editor relationship look like from both sides, since you've been on both sides? And also, if you are a new writer and, you know, people don't know you, how do you establish that relationship if all you've got, you know, is submissions, go to submissions@suchandsuch.com, you know, how do you do that?
You know, I'm very impressed, and it's mostly because of, you know, the managing editor here, Ben Armbruster, really set a tone for when I started, where we do get back to everybody and we address every submission that comes in to the mailbox. I can't say you're going to get the same treatment from every editor, every magazine, you know, only because many are much bigger than us. So we try to say that we're the, you know, foreign policy magazine of restraint, that's what we're punching up at. But foreign policy has a staff that's, you know, like three times as big as the Quincy Institute, like bigger than our parent, you know, organization. So I would imagine if you're just kind of pitching cold to a magazine that big, it's going to be difficult for, I can't say either way whether what their process is. I know from our processes, we try to address every single article that comes into the box and answer back. But how do you distinguish yourself in a bigger magazine? It's hard to say. When I was freelancing, I had a difficult time doing cold calls. You know, I'll be very honest with you. So often, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to an end run, you know, the general mailbox. Say you found my email online, which is pretty easy. You know, putting me in emailing me directly is going to get my it's going to get my attention faster. And I would imagine that would be like for anybody, any editor that you found a personal email online for, why not? If you feel comfortable doing it, or, you know, the good old fashioned, like, do, you know, find out who might know somebody at that magazine or organization and try to get an introduction. And that, of course, is going to be helpful. You know, that's how things are done, especially, you know, in this business, in journalism. It's, you know, like making those connections. You know, aside from all that, I mean, so say you only go through the pitch box. Well, you really got to make sure it's a great pitch. And there's ways of doing that. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said you got excited about articles where you felt nobody has read this before and you're going to be publishing it tomorrow. It's very exciting. That's the kind of pitch that I want, where I feel like I'm getting an angle that I haven't read before or something I hadn't thought of before. I personally like historical pitches. I like when people can find a little nugget in the past and compare it to something that's happening today, or how that might be, how today's events might be informed by an historical event. I've had articles comparing, you know, today's generals, the general in the Civil War, you know. And it sounds a little kitschy, but actually people like to read that stuff. I like to read that stuff. It's, you know, it's teaching me something. And I feel like if you have a pitch where you can wow the editor by saying, oh my goodness, I never thought of that before. I think that's going to get their attention. You got to come through with the actual article, the draft, and that doesn't mean, you know, taking or going overboard and trying to like pretzel twist, you know, a historical event into a pretzel just to make a point or to try to pitch something different. I've gotten pitches where, you know, the comparisons or analogies didn't really quite fit, like they were reaching too far too. So it just, I guess you just gotta be smart about it.
Yeah. And like, what is just, you know, to think through like the actual concrete execution, like what's a good pitch email look like, you know, the subject line, the lines of text, all of that, like what, yeah, you know, what do you say?
I mean, as an editor who's like reading copy all day and obviously every editor is going to be biased when they see a familiar face or a familiar person sending something to them, they are going to immediately open that one first. So you're at a disadvantage if you're just pitching coldly. So I would say the best thing to do is to have a pitch that is very short and concise. I don't know how many people on the call right now are journalists, but what I call it is a nut graph. You basically have the theme of the piece right there front and center. You're telling the editor exactly the point you're going to get to. I've had too many pitches where the pitch was almost as long as the story itself, and it meandered and everything in the kitchen sink was in there, and it was just too explanatory, and that, you know, my eyes are like, you know, glazing over. You need something that's short and sharp, gets to the point. And then have your bio like at the bottom of it. You know, explain to the editor upfront who you are, what's your background, maybe a couple clips that you have, like other published pieces. I know we've, you know, so many times, you know, me and my colleagues will be like, well, we can't find any record of this person online. We're a little nervous. Because in this day and age, you have people who are working for PR agencies and consultant agencies who are generating content and are masquerading as independent academics or columnists or what have you. And they're really getting paid to promote a particular point of view And it's usually foreign countries are doing this, but you know, even domestically, there are plenty of PR consultancies that pay people to generate content. They're lobbyists, really. And so I'm not saying that that's everywhere, it's happening every day, but if you get a pitch and you don't know who this person is and you Google them and they barely have a footprint, you start wondering and, you know, okay. So if you're legit, I would say, give us a CV or a resume and just a few of your, and say, and believe me, not everybody's published. So that's not going to be necessarily a black mark against you. I know that, John, you've sent writers to me. I know John Quincy Adams Society has sent writers who are right out of school or still in school. And we've published them. You can go on our site right now. And there are plenty of bios that will say, so-and-so is a student. So they're not going to have a huge bibliography of things that they have published. But, you know, in that case, let us see where you are, what you're doing. And that way we can see it all right there in the pitch. And we don't have to play a guessing game.
I definitely agree. And you know, and I think just even, you know, the subject line, just saying in a sentence what you're going to say. Right. You know, the first sentence having that kind of key message right there, like that's so, because also, you know, if you're getting, you know, 50, 100 pitches in a day, you might be like, okay, yeah. I don't have much time to sit here and process this and get five paragraphs in. Yeah. And also, if it takes you five paragraphs to make your point, I don't want to edit a piece like that because I'm going
to
have to.
Exactly. That makes you a little nervous about what you're going to get. But, and another thing I want to mention is that because we're a magazine, our writing is completely different than the academic writing that many of new foreign policy writers are used to. And I get that. And this happened to me when I was at the American Conservative as well on other issues. I used to get like, here I get a lot of, foreign policy, international relations, students, you know, maybe regional analysts or just coming out of school. When I was at the American Conservative, I had a ton of political science majors. That was like, and they would pitch me stories that sounded like they're about to lay one on me in terms of a term paper, and it would give me a headache. And I said, well, if I can't slog through this, I don't know how a regular reader. And I always have to assume that my readership is not just, they're not just experts on one thing or another. And many of them are coming from directions unknown to me. So I'm not going to throw them a paper or an article that reads like an academic article. It just can't work. We have to keep a standard in which, you know, we're not dumbing down. So I want to say that right now, our quality, I believe, in our writing is excellent, and we maintain that. But it is also in a voice that is a lot more journalistic, a lot newsier, a lot more free flowing and informational, and not, the academic. We don't want people to write for their academic peers. We want them to write for a much broader audience that you want to convince your whatever argument you're making or any information that you want to impart. You want to bring as many people along as you can. And some people will be coming in at a very lower level in terms of their understanding of a particular region or concept. And other people might be coming at a much higher, you know? And so we want to make sure, you know, that we're addressing all of those people. But I would say in the pitches themselves, that would probably not help if you're addressed it, like your pitch reads like an abstract to a research study.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like academic writing definitely incentivizes, stuff like adding a lot of caveats on any claim that you want, you know, and using like really complex sentence structures. Uh-huh. Maybe you don't get to the point because you've got like a lit review beforehand. You feel like you have to include every perspective on an issue and then explain why your perspective is right. Whereas like if a proper, like, especially more like in the op-ed space, but into essays and writing, it's almost more like, it can be more like the old five paragraph essay where it's just like, here's what I'm going to say and three reasons that I think it's true.
Yeah.
Here's a paragraph on each of those reasons. And then here's me restating my thesis. I mean, honestly, if you can state your opinion that directly and using simple language that like anybody can understand, you probably have a better understanding of it anyway.
Yeah.
That was always a big pet peeve of mine, just the complexity. And a lot of the programs that we do with the society, like our Marcellus Policy Fellowship, is basically trying to teach people how to write for like regular people and not just, you know, political science quarterly. Honestly, just like trying to write like you're writing to somebody that you know, who's kind of like the person in the audience. I always do that.
Or conversational.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I agree with you there. And I'm glad you're doing that because I don't think the problem is that there are publications out there that accept that. But I know that my publication, just like with the American Conservative, and I'm sure the National Interest and others, are trying to reach a broader audience. And it's just that it's a mismatch. And I do have to remind people you're not writing for your peers. And I get that with academics because they have the sense that they have to show their peers, well, I'm aware of every nuance in this issue. And I'm going to make sure that every one of them is addressed, because if I don't, somebody will think I don't know what I'm talking about, or I haven't taken something to an account that other experts like myself should know. And I have to remind them that they are not your audience. You don't have to prove anything. you have to persuade outside of this beltway or outside of the academic circles in which you work. So yeah, it is definitely a different type of writing for sure.
Yeah. And folks that are listening, if you've got questions, feel free to drop them in here in the Q&A feature. But another question I'd ask is about communication with authors and kind of the timeline between submission and publication. Because I might submit a piece, and then how long, you know, from your publication, from a typical publication, might it be before I hear back? If I've got something that's kind of time sensitive, like say, you know, since you're talking about Kazakhstan right here, you know, if I wrote something on that and that's kind of a developing event, that's not going to stay current for 3 weeks if you sit on it. Can I say like, hey, I'm giving you a week to look at this and I'm going to take it somewhere else? Like, what should my expectations be as an author? Because I think a lot of people say, hey, well, I haven't heard anything in a week, but I really don't want to bother them, so I'm not going to follow up. And sometimes you will get authors who are just like on you so much, you're just like, I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, it's sort of like, it's a threading the needle situation, because you don't want to antagonize editors. I mean, I wouldn't get easily antagonized, but I'm, you know, like I said, I'm a little more sensitive than some other editors are, I believe. And we're a smaller operation. So if you're not hearing from us within a week, I would have no qualms about, you know, you just shooting an email and say, hey, you know, just wondering, I sent this over on Monday. It's a bit time sensitive because of the issue. You know, there's diplomatic ways of saying it. Just wondering if you might be interested, you know. And a lot of times a situation like that might not have gotten a response because it fell through the cracks, because that happens. You know, I thought Jim said something, or I thought Ben might have sent something. Oh, it turns out all of us are pointing the fingers. Well, I thought you got back to him, you know. So that does happen, especially when we're not working all in the office at the same time. So yeah, then we'll feel guilty and we'll say, oh my God, I'm so sorry, you know, we're taking a look or whatever. I think we have not, I mean, it's happened if it's like over a weekend, like if somebody sends us something on a Friday or a Saturday, and then it gets lost in that inbox. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, like, oh my goodness, I never saw this guy. But so I can only speak for responsible statecraft. I don't mind getting a reminder, especially after, if it's been a few days and it's a timely subject. And I think there's ways that you can nudge without being annoying. I can't speak for other editors. I think if you have a timely issue, I think that should be well within reason for any publication for you to wait several days, maybe three or four, if it's a timely issue, and just shoot another email. Now, if you still don't hear anything, you know, it might be that they're not interested, and they're the types of editors who don't get back to every single writer. And that's unfortunate. But I found, and I'll be perfectly honest, having worked in this town, Washington, DC, for 20 years, that not everybody has good social skills, and they're not, you know, somehow they miss the class on I'm just being, you know, of simple courtesies. So, you know, you might not hear back from them. You might hear back from them initially and not hear from them back ever again. And it's not personal. It's just these editors don't have incorporated these simple courtesies in their process, which is too bad, because as a writer know what it's like not to hear back. And that same goes for job interviews and other things where you feel like you're on pins and needles. Like, hey, I just mustered up the courage to send a pitch or a story. And now I'm getting crickets. It feels awful. And so I try to work with editors, and, you know, writers. And then sometimes there's that, you know, situation where we don't want the story or we don't want the pitch. And it wasn't what we're looking for. And so we try to be nice about it. Like, hey, this isn't really a good fit for us right now. It's a little out of our scope, but feel free to send us another pitch. You know, so, I mean, very rarely will we be very short, because sometimes we get some strange submissions from people we don't know if are bots or not. And then, you know, we'll just say, sorry, no, you know, that's it. But we try to be nice.
Yeah, and I definitely tried to be as communicative with authors as I could, especially, on stuff like, you know, oh, we had another piece come in because some crisis happened and we're going to have to push your piece back a couple right. days. Because I try to tell them when it's going to run, when they can expect it, all that.
Yeah.
As an editor, you've just got a lot on your plate, because you've got this kind of torrent of stuff coming at you. You've got to keep, you know, things moving through your process. You've got lots of communications. I mean, on the editing side, it really is about having a good process in place, or you just drown. Right. We got a question from Michael Culp, who asks, what are your thoughts on using an online writing assistant, tools like Grammarly? Do you think that these are really key or what?
I don't use them. So I don't feel like I'm in the right position to like say yay or nay on them. I'm pretty old school. I'm a little older. So I haven't really taken advantage of those kind of things. I don't know. John, do you have any any experience with them yourself? Because I find like too many bells and whistles actually make it more difficult for me. I find like the old, like a very streamlined process is better for me personally.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the same for me, but I you and I both have written a lot. So it's easier probably for us. I mean, I think especially if someone, you know, feels like it's not their strong suit, it could potentially help. Although things like Microsoft Word, the spell check and the tools that they have in that are actually a lot better at picking out style now than they were, you know, 15, 20 years
Big
ago,
time.
Where it was not really that reliable at all. I think it can be useful for some folks, but honestly, just being more conscious of structure, I think, is what's most helpful for a lot of developing writers. Another question came in from my colleague, Julie, who says, for those of us who are recovering academic writers, are there ways to take an academic paper and turn it into a shorter op-ed or an essay? What's the best way to take research that's been done for a paper and remake it into something people in kind of the Washington foreign policy cognoscenti want to read?
I mean, that's a great question. And it's one of my favorite things about being an editor, because I have often gotten work, you know, whether it came in the form of like research or an article that's way too in the weeds or academic, but somehow it is actually timely in that there is something going on in the news that speaks to it, that it could actually serve as, you know, a way to help people comprehend an issue much better than the stupid mainstream news. So let's marry these two things together. And I feel like, let's just take Kazakhstan, for example. You know, Julie, if you had sent me a paper, a research that you had done on Kazakhstan, even if it wasn't like last week or last month, but something you had done like the year before or 6 months before, that gave like some the background, the dynamics of what was going on the ground there, what had led to the protests, for example, I was like, okay, you take the meat and potatoes of your paper. I, you know, just think of yourself as a reader and say, I have no idea. Where is Kazakhstan? What is you know, who are the leadership there? Why are people pissed off? And then use your paper to flesh that out. And I guess as an editor, I'd possibly help them with, you know, writing a lead that's really going to grab people, that speaks to the headlines, and a little bit of buildup, and then using all of the research, the hard information to explain to people in a way that's not turgid. It's not like, oh my God, I'm like in the weeds, but that shows that this is a complex issue and I'm going to explain it and it's going to be sourced and it's going to mean something. And nobody else is going to have that quickly on their site because they're scrambling, trying to find, you know, experts on Kazakhstan. And here one just came in and handed me a golden nugget. That's how I would see it. And so I think that if you're a writer and you're just coming out of academia and you see something in the news that you think, wow, I think this could really pop because everybody's trying to figure out what's going on right now. And I happen to know what's going on because I've been studying this for 3 or 4 years. I would set up, just like John and I had explained, a simple nut graph themed, you know, pitch and get that over an editor right away, and then attach your work. Say, I've been writing about this. This is my research paper from, you know, 2020. And I would like to explain this, that, and this of what you're seeing on the news right now. And I don't know any editor in this space worth their salt who wouldn't give that a second look, because they're looking for people who can go beneath the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and I think that also that timeliness can be really, really valuable, because on the editing side, you know, when a big event happens, if you want to be part of the conversation, you have to be ready to, you know, kind of drop everything, get on. I mean, I remember the 2016 coup in Turkey. I had been working, I'd had a really long week, and I pull up Twitter at like 4:30 on a Friday or 5:30 in the afternoon, thinking, all right, I'm finally done. And you know, and I see these F-16s flying over Ankara. And I was just like, oh,
it was a Friday. I remember that.
This is going to be a long, long weekend. And I remember we had one of our authors who'd written for us a few times before. And I can't remember if I reached out to him or he reached out to me, but he's like, hey, I'm going to write about this. And I was like, thank you. Like, this is a guy who's a legit expert who, you know, like, his, you know, anybody should be killing for his point of view. And I think he was actually there at the time. Thankfully not anywhere near the action, but I was just like so grateful. And, you know, the moment his piece came in, I dropped everything I was doing and edited it and got it up. So I was like, this is what we need.
Yeah, it's gold.
And, you know, and as an editor, like, that's, you know, your publisher and everybody that kind of is in your chain is looking to you to be able to do that kind of quick turnaround. And so that, you know, that's really valuable. And I think it also gets to something, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on too, finding your voice as a writer, like realizing, hey, I have something to say. Like, how can you tell early on? How do you develop your perspective, your point of view, your confidence as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this, but it just takes time. You know, I feel like, and I've worked with so many younger writers who are, I can see them sort of feeling their way on how to get that voice because they're so used to writing academic material, like devoid of any voice, devoid of any opinion or perspective. It's just the facts, you know, like we had talked about, you know, you know, it's more of a rapport research, as opposed to even having the reader sense that you have any, you know, stake in the outcome. And so you kind of have to, you know, start thinking differently when you're writing. You know, I know you have an opinion. So I would prefer, see, I'm not a huge fan of op-eds, like the regular 500 word op-ed that are just, it's just a set of talking points. And it's usually telling people what they already know, but it's making them feel good because they maybe already believe in that way. You know, it's part of the whole echo chamber. And I believe that op-eds have their place. I'm just saying that if I prefer more of a hybrid where you're, you know, you can be upfront about how you feel about this, you know, whether it be, you know, for example, Anatol Levin, who is our Russia expert at the Quincy Institute, has a very prominent point of view about how NATO should not expand further eastward. There should not be further sanctions. That's not going to help the situation. And that we need to start negotiating some sort of like Minsk II agreement on Russia, because any of this antagonism, you know, that's been going on between Russia and the US and over Ukraine is just escalating tensions. And he has particular prescriptions for that. And so he doesn't mince words. He's going to tell you, this is how I feel about this. But what's good about his writing is that he has research, he has reporting, you know, he has sourcing, everything to flesh out his opinion. So it's not just a straight, here's my take it or leave it. It is, this is why you should, it's persuasion. And so I think those are the best, and you'll find your voice after a while. If you are more and more comfortable injecting your perspective, your point of view into an article, you'll start to feel a little bit more comfortable in a more conversational style, and people will recognize, you know, oh, that's John, that's Kelly, you know, and maybe not right away, but over time you will feel comfortable in your own skin when you're writing, and it'll come out. Personally, I feel like I don't inject myself. I try not to use the first person pronoun I at all, unless I really have to. And I try not to be, I try to stay, and I believe I do stay away from ad hominem attacks or being too sarcastic and taking pot shots at people. Some people are kind of good. They're a little bit more of they're more satirical writers. They're more wordsmithy, you know, and you pick them up right away. I feel like I have a more of a newsy kind of voice where I want to put everything out there and have you decide. But you will know where I'm coming from. So everybody's going to have to sort of feel their way on that question. But I think it does take time. I think coming right out of school or your first job and starting in this space, you know, I think the most important thing is just to get the fundamentals right in terms of writing for magazines. And I think the rest will come a little more naturally. You know, it did for me, but it took many years.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of in that early stage just feel like kind of, you know, who am I to be out here saying stuff, sharing my opinion with the world on this? And honestly, one of the number one things I tell people is like, hey, you know, there are going to be regular columnists, you know, for instance, like the political columnist, when a foreign policy issue breaks big enough that it becomes a political issue, who's going to write about that? Who's maybe read one book about it 5 years ago, or maybe they talked to two people or something like that. You know, because if you follow an issue really closely, you'll kind of realize when they're doing that. Because like I remember with the Iran deal, like I had been following it very closely for years, and then it was a big deal and everybody was saying something about it. And I was like, wait a minute, I know way more about this than these guys. You know, so you feel not only a right to be part of the conversation, but also almost a responsibility, because it's like, hey, well, if these clowns get to have an opinion and people are going to be looking to them and I know more about it, I should be out there. Like, you know, you feel a sense of obligation.
It's frustrating too. Yeah. Because those are the people who are getting all the play and you're struggling, you know, to get published. I'm not you particularly, but I've been in that position where I felt in the same way, but particularly doing it during the war, I started doing more opinion writing. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I had been writing straight news all up until 2005 or so. And I made a concerted leap over the fence because I was looking around and I was seeing all of these people pontificating about the war, but not really knowing what they were talking about. And in my view, they weren't talking about it in the right way. A lot of it was cheerleading. A lot of it was just bandwagoneering, repeating what other people were saying. I mean, the blob was just so strong back then that people just felt comfortable repeating what their peers were saying. And yet they were getting thousands of hits on their blogs at the time and on mainstream outlets. And it was very frustrating. So I said, you know what? Screw the straight news. I mean, I still had a job or I had to do like straight news reporting, but I started on the side just writing about the war. But I figured I'd do the hybrid. I'm not just going to spend 500 to 1,000 words, you know, in a screed about how I hated George Bush and Dick Cheney and all that. But I took an issue that I felt that was underreported. And I did research and interviewed people. And I said, this is why you should think this way, basically, but don't take my word for it. Take this person's word for it. Take, you know, this data, you know, put it all together. And I felt like that's what I felt comfortable doing because I came from a journalistic, a reporting background. I wanted to use that, you know, to persuade people. And I think that's been very helpful to me, but I agree with you. And I see that today with the Afghanistan withdrawal. There were so many people writing about it in a span of a week that hadn't written about Afghanistan. They hadn't paid attention to it. They could care less. And then all of a sudden when, you know, everything was going to hell during the withdrawal and fingers were pointing, all of a sudden, all of the top national columnists were weighing in a way like they had always been there talking about Afghanistan, but you could tell, like you said, that their analysis was no deeper than a teaspoon. It just sounded good and was getting millions of hits on Washington Post and, you know, New York Times and The Atlantic and all these places. So it is frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that even extends up to television. Like half the time, you know, if you play the game long enough, you kind of know who the people are, and you're like, why is this guy up here talking about this?
Right.
We've got a question from Daniel Thayer. What are some writing pitfalls you see a lot that should be avoided?
Well, we talked about some of them. I do feel like whether it's a pitch or a draft, you know, you have to keep in mind that this isn't a term paper. This isn't a report. This isn't a research paper. And that can be a very big turnoff, particularly if it sounds like you are almost like there have been times where I've gotten papers where if I'm stymied, like I said earlier, if I'm not understanding, if I have to reread a paragraph three times to get what you're saying, and sometimes it's like you said, John, where there's just one long run-on sentence, you know, with it's just that's a big turnoff, I believe, to editors, because they're looking at that and they're going, oh my goodness, I got to do a lot of editing on this. And sometimes it's not worth it. You say, well, when you distill this all down, is this actually advancing people's knowledge of an issue? Is this anything different than we had last week on responsible statecraft? You know, and if it's not, sometimes we'll just say, you know what, this isn't worth it. And I feel bad, but you know, then there are others where it's like, there's something in there, but we're going to have to spend a lot of time editing it just to get to the gold inside, you know, the diamond in the rough or whatever. You know, but I don't put your editors through that. You know, I mean, I feel like just spend a little time making sure, you know, and let's be honest, this is a, you know, this medium, you know, magazine, even if it's a foreign policy and we are the subject areas are a little more elevated than what you might find on, Politico and other places, you know, this is still the internet. And people, are really interested in reading 5,000 word pieces, not even 2,000 word pieces these days. People's attention spans are short. Long, blocky paragraphs. I will literally chop, paragraphs up and find, I believe this is borne out in some like rules of, site optimization. They like short paragraphs, So I think if you kind of know the rules in terms of what a good magazine article in this space, foreign policy, should look like, then try to conform that when you approach an editor. And I'm trying to think of other pitfalls. I think that's don't try to impress too much. You know, I think, and believe me, I've done this. I looked at my writing from like many years ago and I'm like, because I was trying a little too hard. You know, I was trying to use too many, like almost like very word salad-y, I had an editor call me up one time and, we're still friends today, but he's like, your sentences need to be more shorter and concise. You're just sort of like, you're just putting too much in there and they're running on. And I got my backup. I was like, I thought my sentences were just fine. And then I look back at it and I'm like, he was right. And I was being stubborn. I thought I knew what I was doing. So I feel like, I do feel like don't try so hard. Don't try to impress these imaginary readers out there and show them how much you know. Just remember, you don't want to think your readers are all stupid or anything, but you want to bring them in and write like you're having a conversation. And I think that'll get you going on the right track.
Yeah, I think another thing kind of related to that, trying to jam too much into a sentence, is that you can try to jam too much into a piece, too many moving parts.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of new writers feel like, hey, I've got a lot of thoughts and I'm writing for the public, so I'm going to put it all in here. And if you've got two different big ideas in a piece, that's probably just two pieces. Because if you can get published once, you can get published again.
That's a really good point, John. It's not even about putting too many things in it, but putting too many themes, like you said, that you'd be talking about an election here, but then all of a sudden go to some historical thing there and then go over here. And then the editor's like, well, what's your point? I thought you were going to talk about this, but then you ended up, and believe me, I was so guilty of this. I look at some of my pieces and I'm not going to tell you where they are because you can find them right now and then you'll laugh at me. But not that they're bad, but they went on forever. And bless his heart, my editor didn't say, you can tighten this up a little bit. And I feel like he would have done me a favor if he gave me a word limit. And he said, Kelly, you need to say it wasn't 1200, but maybe 1600. You need to keep that. And I would have been like, oh, come on, I can't do all this great stuff in 16. Oh yeah, you can. And I bet I'd be looking at those pieces today in a different light, because it would have forced me to self-edit, like control, put some guardrails on what I was doing. Because I did exactly what you said. I went over here and I went over there and I'm putting all links in and I'm really smart. And the next thing you know, it was like a 2000 word piece. And I forgive me, anybody who's out there right now and might have a favorite website that you go to and people are writing for 2,000-3,000 words. And you think, because I have friends who have websites and they write stories for websites, and I won't name them, who are perfectly fine with 3,000 word foreign policy pieces. But I read them and I go, I think they could have wrapped this up like 7 paragraphs. I'm not trying to be mean. I just think that, and then there's those real, there's special pieces. And I'll say this, my late friend, Mark Perry, he would write a piece And it would be way longer than the word count that we usually had. At American Conservative, our word count was 1,500. And he would send in like a 2,000 word piece, and I wouldn't realize it because I was just like so engrossed in what he was saying. And he was a storyteller. So he was telling it like a story. And next thing you know, it was the end. And I was like, wow, that was great. And then I would go to, how many words is this? 2,000? I was like, it didn't feel like it. But I have to say that not many writers can do that on and in every single story that they write.
Yeah, it has absolutely. To be
really special.
Yeah. And you know, I think that narrative style, when you really know your stuff, you can sometimes pull that off, but that's hard.
Yeah.
I've got another question here from Michael Mikowski. And sorry if we're running a little long here. A beginning writer on foreign policy and politics, do you recommend focusing and honing in on one topic, region, beat, or trying to learn and write more broadly until you have, you know, kind of some clips built up? Is it better to go general or to specialize?
I would say specialize at first. So when I started writing, I was writing very narrowly about the war, and I kind of kept in that. So like you'll see in my own bio, it's like national security, veterans, you know, the war on terror, you know, like I know those are very broad topics, but I didn't try to write about more broadly about other things. And now I feel more emboldened as a seasoned writer to kind of be the columnist, you know, where I can kind of, I can write about different things. But I don't know if I'd feel that confidence back in the day. And also I feel like if you can prove to an editor that you are an expert in one area, whether it be a regional expert, or maybe you're interested in grand strategy and you can talk about grand strategy as it's applied to, you know, Russia, China, or other places, those editors you'll build trust with an editor that you will be a go-to person for them when something does come up. And I think that's more important to me as an editor. I'm a little skeptical, I have to say, when a younger writer comes in, he goes, well, can I write about Venezuela? And then the next week he wants to write about China. And then the next week, he or she wants to write about, you know, what's going on with the Olympics, you know, like they're just bouncing off the headlines, which I guess if you've been around, if you're like Doug Bandow and you've been writing articles for 35 years, yeah, sure. I trust Doug can, you know, he can manage that. But a younger writer, it almost sounds like they're just trying to get something published, and and I'm not so sure that their analysis is going to be that well informed. So I would say that if you're just coming out of school and you've spent the last several years talking and really interested in one subject, one issue area, I would say use that to your advantage, because you're going to signal to the editor that A, you know what you're talking about and that you're interested in it. And if you do well and they start publishing you, then there will be a moment like when a coup happens and an editor goes, oh my God, I got to find somebody who knows about this area because I don't know. And they're going to go, oh, you know, Julie knows, call her up, you know, and then you've established a relationship. The generalists don't do as well unless you're some older person who just, their name is their selling point. You know, like I have a few of those who are, you know, older former government officials, and they happen to work in like the CIA or State Department. And so, you know, anything they're going to say broadly, you can kind of bring it to the bank, you know, that they're good, and they may have some name, their byline means something, but that's a lot different from somebody who's an unknown quantity.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a kind of a more technical question here from someone asking, what format should you submit a piece in, you know, Google Docs, Word Docs? I've gotten pieces as PDFs, which I imagine you probably share my view on getting a submission as a PDF. They asked, you know, is Google Docs, is that better? What do you like?
I mean, we like Google Docs because they're easily shared within the team. Don't tell anybody, but I don't have Word on my laptop. I used to, I hate it. And with the newer Apples, it doesn't come installed. You have to purchase it. You got to download it. And so they have Pages, which is a real pain. And so if you give me a Word doc and I open it and start editing it, I'll be editing in Pages, and then nothing that I do will necessarily translate. And I have to, it's a mess. That's my fault. I should have Word, but I encourage everybody to use Google Docs, because that way, even if, there's some cases, especially my older writers don't like Google Docs. They're like, I don't get this. And they just want to use Word. I mean, I can edit it in Google Docs with my team, and then I can just download it into a Word file and send it back to them. But I think, you know what, and you can probably scratch everything I said, because every editor is going to be different. Like I did, I worked on a piece for the American Spectator. They wanted it in a Word doc. Then they got nervous and they said, well, just send it in the body of the email. Because sometimes it's such a pain with the translations that sometimes the body of the email, if I was sending a cold, like, okay, if I was submitting something cold and you want to send a whole draft, which I don't really recommend that, but say, I would just put it in the body of the email and attach it as a Word document. Because I'm thinking if you share a Google, you can't really share a Google Doc cold, because they might not, you'd have to give them permission and all that crap. So I think the first initial volley should probably be in the body of the email and then attached as a Word. And then if the editors want to put it in another format, they can. Does that make sense? I'm sorry.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I mean, that's what I do when I submit a piece somewhere right now, is I have an email, you know, where I'm just kind of saying, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so, I've got a piece about such and such. It's below, it's pasted below and attached.
Yeah.
And I'll have it pasted right there. And then I'll have the same thing attached in Word. Cause it, yeah. You know, at least at TNI, our process was typically, we would just take it and put it in Google Docs, cause we had a shared drive, and we would edit it there. I actually sometimes would edit in hard copy, so I'd then print it out and mark it up. And then load that in if I was like really needed to do that. But yeah, like the easier it is to copy and paste. I hated PDFs. Immediately, I would just be like, do not, like, please send me this as a Word doc. Cause you ultimately have to put it into your website, and you can't do that with a PDF.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Only gotten that a few times in the last year. I mostly get Word docs and cut and pastes. You know, sometimes they edit, if you've accepted the piece, and they'll ask you what format do you want? And if they're willing, put it in a Google Doc, and then we can just start right off the bat. But yeah, you're right. I should have had you answer that question, because my roundabout answer probably exhausted us like 3-4 minutes.
Yeah. Although I was last editing full time, you know, probably, gosh, 6 years ago at this point, so, or 5 and a half. So I'm not as current, you know, like we didn't natively use Google Docs the same way as you guys do. You know, you mentioned outlines and whether to send in the full draft. Do you prefer to receive, Marco Massad is asking this, do you prefer receiving an outline for an article before they write it, before they send you the full article?
Yes. And I try to convey that to writers. Like I'd rather get a pitch, because sometimes, you know, the pitch is promising, but there are other things that I want from it, or we need from it. And then if it's just a pitch, we could say, yeah, this sounds good, but is there any way that you can do this instead? Or can you kind of flesh it out this way? And if you're able to work with the writer at the outset, then that will cut down any chance for disappointment when the full thing comes in. But if they just give you a full draft, it's easier to say, hey, this doesn't fit, you know, like, I just feel like, or sorry, we just had a piece on this a day ago and we don't really need it. Now, if it was just a pitch, we'd be able to say, well, sorry, we've already had this. Is there any way, you know, you might be able to maybe update it, or, you know, think of something else. I just find it easier when it's just a pitch.
Another question from Anthony Hu says, what can writers do if they learn of new information or something happens that changes their viewpoint after they've been published?
Well, it depends on how severe or how big of a change in point of view that you're experiencing. I mean, if it's something that you really want to get out there, you could always ask an editor, say, listen, I wrote this piece about XYZ. And since then I've learned all of these new things and it's changed the way I look. I'm looking at the situation. Can I write another story and be very upfront about it? There's no way. I don't know if Anthony is asking whether he could go back or somehow, you know, take down the story. I mean, what kind of change of heart is he talking about? Is it, you know, oh my God, I can't believe I wrote that and I don't want other people to see it. Cause then I'm afraid, I think you're probably stuck with it, but if it feels really important to you, then just write another story and be upfront and like saying, in light of the new things that I've learned, I've, you know, changed my opinion about this. I don't know. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think that's probably the right approach. I mean, especially if it's like an important issue, you know, because yeah. I was thinking about, you know, Fukuyama turning against the Iraq war. And, it, you know, that was worth writing an article about. And it like started a civil war among the neocons about it. But like most stuff, you know, that was also because he was a well-known name and an opinion shaper in that movement. And it was newsworthy, literally newsworthy, that he was changing his opinion on that. If it's something that's, you know, peripheral to your field of expertise and you're not super well known and it's not a big, big important issue, you know, it might even be a little bit vain to think that everybody needs to know about your change of heart. And even if you know, and even then some other ways that you could deal with that, you know, you could put up a post on Medium. You could tweet about it. It's something you could, you know, talk about in, you know, in conversation with people. I mean, there are certainly a lot of people in Washington who say, yeah, I mean, I supported the Iraq war when it happened. And then I realized it was a bad idea. I mean, that's another way to handle it. They don't necessarily have to, like, everybody who changed their mind about Iraq didn't go and write a big professional essay, even though more of them probably should have. One last question on that. If someone wants to pitch you at Responsible Statecraft right now, like, how do they do that? You know, where should they send it? All that.
Well, we do have the infamous pitch box, and I want to make sure that I believe it's pitchrs@quincyinst.org, but I'm going to make sure so I'm not like spreading fake news. Yeah, it's pitchrs@quincyinst.org. And if you want, feel free to CC me on that. I mean, I'll see it anyway, but if you want my email for whatever reason, it's just vlahos@quincyinst.org. And let us know where you're coming from. It's always nice to have the personal touch saying, you know, I'm coming from the Marcellus, fellowship or John Quincy Adams or whatever. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm giving special preference, but it is good to have like personal touch, like, okay, I know where this is coming from. And it's just, you know, that's just anything that you can send. And it's not just to me, but any editor where you feel like you can just kind of let them know, even if it's something really, you know, somewhat gratuitous, like, oh, I was reading Responsible Statecraft and I noticed this and I used to work here or I knew this or, you know, some sense of, you know, just customization, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But it does help when I know it's coming from trusted sources like John Quincy Adams Society. I'll be very honest with you. It helps.
Hey, yeah, and I'm certainly happy to have people enhance the reputation of the society by associating their good work with us. So So with that, thank you. We're with Kelly Vlahos, who's been sharing her wisdom about writing and editing. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Kelly, and everybody, have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, everybody.